Decoded Podcast, Season 4, Episode 1. I'm Roland Chidiak. He's Chris Clough. Can you believe it, Chris? We're starting our fourth season of you and I chatting on the weekend about
being technically we started our fourth season an hour and 10 minutes ago.
Yeah, but hey, if it's not recorded, it doesn't count, right?
That's right. What's on the on-ramp stays on the on-ramp.
That's right. Well, some of it leaks out, but not with the same vigor or passion that is expressed on the on-ramp.
There's honesty and then there's honesty.
Yeah. Well, we have to remember, I mean, we're both leaders in our community, mm-hmm. right? So we have to make sure that we have that standard to uphold. And I don't think we do it a disservice. I think we just, like you said, there's always going to be a difference between two people talking privately and two people talking publicly. Some people don't have that filter, and they believe, in my opinion, they believe that they're like, I'm being true to me and I'm being true to this and true to that. And I'm like, that's fine. Are you in a position of responsibility? Mm-hmm. Are you in a position of influence? Because I think when you enter into those positions of influence, authority, power, I think it's important to consider those things, and you can still address whatever it is you want to talk about. You just need to think before you speak. That's all. That's my opinion.
What was the individual that you talked with? I have to put on political cloaking. What was the
political cloak? I need to put on the political cloak, and I like it, and I understand it. Mm-hmm. I understand it. And this person is in a position of more authority than myself, and it's that, you know, people are watching this person. I don't mean watching in a negative way. I mean, this person's out there, so people hear this person. They see what this person's doing, and it informs their practice. It informs their opinions. It informs the way that they might want to operate. And so you can still speak your truth. You should be careful, I think, with how you speak your truth, because people, you're a model for people. That's all. And that's just my opinion, my position.
It's a tough one to explain. I think it's also a tough one to, I think it's a tough conversation to decode. There's a whole lot of fragility going on right now. And I think that some of the individuals, let's go to Pascal. What's his full name?
Charles Pascal.
Charles Pascal. Pascal, sir, if you're listening, correct me. I'll try both versions. Charles, his shout out this past week to individuals who feel like there might be ministerial reprisal for sharing what schools look like on the ground in the class, that mention to send him stuff and he will post it on your behalf. I think the dude, he's a professor at OISE, I think. I think he's at U.
Yeah, he's at OISE, U of T professor, but he mm-hmm. used to be the deputy minister of education.
Dang, I didn't even know that.
Back in the day, yeah. Okay. So when he speaks about this stuff, like, people listen because he's been in the position, right? So he mm-hmm. kind of gets it, and obviously he doesn't agree with the current government's operation, especially around education. So it's cool to have his perspective.
Yeah. And so a little bit of that fragility, there's a whole lot of people that are going through the experience of opening up their classrooms or starting up classes this past week, or, you know, whether they're a parent or they're an educator. If you're an adult responsible for children, then I think you land on a tweet like that and you feel a call to action. You feel a call to action to share. I haven't jumped into the space. I've talked about it in bits and pieces on my feed, but I haven't posted, you know, here's where the pump station goes. Here's what the spacing is. Here's how the spin that's happening from the minister and the premier looks at ground level. I've been in a few conversations, but I haven't, and I've chosen not to post that stuff up. So, but kudos to him to, you know, offer that up. I think there's others that are doing similar stuff. But I think because of what you had mentioned, because of his background, his roots, that maybe some people feel that that's a trusted space to, you know, share their truth.
Well, okay, so I've got his tweet in front of me, and it says, and it was tweeted on September 2nd, he's Charles E. Pascal at C.E. Pascal, P-A-S-C-A-L on Twitter, and this is what he said. He said, to all teachers who have been told you can't take pics of your classrooms because your leaders are fearful of ministerial reprisal, send them to me in confidence. My email is easy to find and I will post anonymously. He's had 52 responses to that tweet. He's had 778 retweets and 2,400 likes. So needless to say, people have seen this tweet and people are interested in this tweet. And hey, I get it, right? Like, I get it. You don't want to put yourself in a position where you're going to be disciplined for being truthful about your situation. But at the same time, you're not going to hide the facts of the situation. So, for example, I tweeted out on my class account, I tweeted out a short, you know, 15-second video of the room. And I did that because I know parents follow my Twitter feed. And they have friends whose kids are maybe in my class. And parents are wanting to know what's happening. What does it look like in the classroom? Like, we're not getting any information for anybody. What's going on? I simply wanted to show my community, hey, the classroom's getting ready. This is kind of what it looks like. So if you need to see this before you come in next week, then here it is. Totally being positive about my experience. I am looking forward to working with my students again. Is it the same as it was in years past? No. But did I tweet it to cause a problem? No. And anybody who looks at my tweet will know that, oh, Roland's just, if you look at my track record, right, you look at the tweets I've put out and the content, you'll see that what I've done is in line with everything I've always done. It's never been a problem before. Why is it a problem now? Right? So from my perspective, it's not an issue. And I don't think I can be disciplined because I've done nothing wrong. And my administrators, they know how I operate. So whatever my issue may be with my work conditions, that's a conversation I have with my union, with my principal. You know, I might mention it to you as my friend and a fellow educator who would understand what I'm talking about. But I'm not walking around in the streets doing that. You know, and I've had lots of parents ask me what I think of what's going on right now in education. I tell them my position as an educator is to be in that room and to do the best job I can to help my students achieve and grow, and so that I can grow too. That's my position as an educator. I also have a position as a parent. I tell them what I think as a parent of two students in the public school system. So I'm allowed to wear different hats. And I think where I put those hats on and how I do that depends on my context and my comfort level. But I think that I always remember that I'm an educator. And with that comes a responsibility that isn't taken lightly. And there's a lot of people out there who are really hating on teachers right now. And they have been actually with the strike and everything. I don't think that they consider what that will. Do I like getting paid well? Yes, I do. Do I like to have a pension? Yes, I do. I paid to become a teacher and I pay for my pension. So there's these common things that we're always, you know, teachers this, teachers that. They don't want to look deeper than that. They just want something to complain about. So you can have that to complain about. If you want to have a real conversation, then we can go there too. And you can see, you know, why I believe that I earn my money. Why I believe that I worked hard to get into the position I'm in. And I'm an educated fellow. I have the credentials to back up what I'm saying here. So there's like a lot of layers there to that. So I'm going to go back to like, I'm not hiding anything. And my principals haven't told me what to post and what not to post. My union is concerned that people are or may do things in a way that is not the right way to do it. And I appreciate that. That's good for people to know. But like, I appreciate Charles coming out and saying, hey, if you don't feel comfortable, you feel conflicted, just send it to me and I'll push it out. No problem. And I think that's important. It's important to have allies. It's important to have people there to look out for you and to help you out. And I appreciate that. I don't think I need to use his services. I just think some people do need that. Before we shift or pivot, I want to say we have a viewer and she's been watching since we started. But you and I were kind of deep there. I wasn't just going to be like, hey, let's stop there and talk about it. So Ramona's checking us out and here I've posted her comment, excited for season 4. So Ramona, thanks for taking time out of your Saturday morning to, listen to Chris and I babble about whatever it is that we're going to babble about. Mm-hmm. And we, full disclosure, we do a podcast with Ramona. So, talk me through your process, the leadership podcast that we just started. So thanks, Ramona. Appreciate you and your time.
And the fact that, I think we got a note there saying, hey boys, when are you going to start? You guys out there? What's going on? And we were stuck, not stuck. We were still, it was a long on ramp. I like her mention, you know, that idea of being excited for season 4. I share that. Maybe similar reasons, maybe different. My reason is because I really don't know what it's going to bring. Like this stuff ain't mapped out. So where we go on the weekly really is reflective of, you know, the high, low, and middle of the week. So I'm excited too, only because I feel like there's going to be so much to talk about this school year. There is always stuff to talk about, but I feel in particular the school year is going to give us a lot of bits to talk about. So I'm excited to, I guess my excitement is more the thrill of the unknown. That's really what it comes. It's the thrill of the unknown, right? So.
Well, I have to say this, the reason our on-ramp was a little bit longer this week, and I don't think it's been as long as other times, but I think it was, the on-ramp today was deeper because both you and I, you know, started work again this last week. Mm-hmm. And I was at school for 3 days of PD, and it's a different world we're living in now, right? Like the start of this school year is unlike any other start. Like everything that would be normal for a startup didn't happen. Like I still don't have an official class list. You know, my vice principal went out of her way to find a way to provide us with a list so that we could have an idea. We could create some of the stuff that we wanted to create to welcome the students on the first day, the first week. But we still don't have an official list. You know, and when I was at work doing the PD, some of the things that because we don't have on a list, that means our Google Classrooms weren't able to be created by the system. Like there's just a bunch of things that would normally occur at particular times in this last week that didn't happen, that couldn't happen, because all the things that make them happen weren't in place. You know, there's a lot of questions about procedures, administrivia type stuff that never have come up before. So these things have caused us to, like, think about our role, whys and hows, and what are you going to do next, and how to operate. And it's like all these things were, for veteran teachers especially, on autopilot. You just have a way to start up. And this startup has been different. Even thinking about, like, everything, like the routines that you introduce to your students and the way you, your philosophy of education, the way you run your classroom, it's all shifted. And you were listening to me debrief on that. So I was telling you that, like, the analogy I used was like a train station. One train stops, another one leaves. And I was telling you that in my head, trains just keep moving. None of them are stopping because they don't know where to stop. They don't know where to stop. It's like you ask a question, there's no answer. So the train's running. And somebody says, hey, have you considered this? No, that train's running. And it's like there's no stopping. There are no answers. There is the, I need to do it to then know what it looks like and what procedure becomes of it. So it's almost like you're working backwards, right? You need to experience it to create the procedure rather than create a procedure and then have them experience it, because there's so many, there's just unknowns, and I feel like there's conflicting messages. So like I told you on the on-ramp, I feel comfortable saying it here. Whatever I do next week, it will be through the lens of safety first. So when my kids say to me, I need to get up and leave my desk and I need to go to the bathroom, how do I leave the room? Then I will address that with the class. And I will say, okay, since I don't really have what I believe is the space I need to map out like a route in the classroom, this is how we're going to operate when a person needs to get up and move. I need to see it. I need to make it happen in order to, like, verbalize it to them. It's never really been like that before. So I think, you know, people keep telling us, you got this, you're going to be fine. Yeah, I'm going to be fine because I'm taking ownership now. So whatever answers I don't have from my admin, I'm taking ownership and I'm going to proceed using the lens of safety so that I can be at peace with myself. Bottom line, right? Because I could do something and somebody could be like, what are you doing? Don't do it that way. Do it this way. And I could be like, okay, I'm even going to try not to take it personally because I know it's not personal. I know that everybody's feeling a level of stress that is like on top of the back to school stress. I get that. So I'm going to try my best not to take anything personally. I'm going to roll with it. But you better believe that when I'm done for the day and I go home, I'm going home, because I'm going to need to get here. I'm going to need to, life continues outside of work. And I've got a wife that I'm going to need to debrief with. And I've got a child that I'm going to need to debrief with. And, you know, I'm almost grateful that high school is starting a week later here, because then I won't have to deal with two kids that need to debrief. So we'll get my youngest underway, and then a week later, my son will start high school, and we still don't really know what that's going to look like, and we're waiting to hear and see that. So, but you know, it's high stress, and I get it, and I'm doing pretty good with my stress. I do have some worries, but I'm kind of just putting them aside for now, in terms of I can't do anything about it, so I'm not going to stress over it. I'm just going to put my mind in different places, right? So I told you I've shifted into planning. So I'm like, actually, I'm planning out my first day, what it looks like. I mean, I always overplan, which is good, because then I can pick and choose what I want to do as time goes on. And I'm a little bit more responsive to my students' needs. So you know, if we jump into a get to know you activity and my students are able to get through it quicker than I thought, or they are slower than I thought, that's okay. Like, I'm going to respond to that. I'm going to learn from that. And I don't know about other teachers, but every time, even in the get to know you activities that I do with my class, I'm always observing, you know, who's going after this, like a dog after a bone, who's doing everything they can to avoid this at all costs. Like, these are the things I need to know about my kids that they're not going to tell me. So, you know, Julia is not going to raise her hand and say, I avoid math at all costs. It's not going to happen. But when I say, hey, let's talk about numbers here for a second, let's do this little activity, and I see her like cower and be like, yeah, don't pick me. Oh, okay. I see that she's not interested in this, and I need to figure out why. I need to figure out what I can do to change that slowly or whatever. So I am going to be fully prepared on paper, right? Because that's part of my job. But will it play out that way? I probably won't get through half of what I plan, and that's okay, because like I said, it's different time. Ramona has been going wild here with the comments. So I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean, she's saying some stuff and I want to honor some of the stuff that she's saying. So she's keeping herself busy while she listens to and watches our podcast. She says, in relation to what we're talking about, do we think some folks are out there intentionally goading teachers right now because they know it may be easy to get a reaction right now? I'm going to let you think about that for a second, Chris. I'm going to put it up and I'm going to answer her question, and then I'd love to hear your answer. I do think there are people out there pushing. I actually know some of my friends on Facebook. I know that they dislike the education system and teachers in general. They're too polite to tell me to come right out and say it, but I can tell by their comments. They know I lean more towards the teacher world. Obviously, they don't. I think they think that we're a bunch of spoiled brats. And so I do believe people are taking it upon themselves right now to kind of poke and dig at the teachers. What do you think, Chris?
If I take this as a social media question, because that's kind of where the sandbox where this is kind of happening, or media in general, I think about the neighborhood that I live in right now, and I don't live with a bunch of teachers. There's a few people know that I'm an educator and that my wife's an educator, but you kind of just see people existing in their neighborhood and kind of going about their business. You know, Steve over there, I can see right now he's working in his garden. There's some people down the street there I can see pulling out of they're in a minivan, they're pulling out, they're leaving the street. And there's a funny kind of bit of like, every once in a while you see people on the street and you kind of give them a gentle nod, or, you know, hey, how's it going? Like, and you think about all those moments of interaction that kind of happened since March 13th. And because we're in kind of mixed groupings here, there's an element of, like, I wouldn't know what's going on in Steve's house that happened just before him coming out and mowing the lawn. I mean, he's not widely sharing in general everything that goes on with his day. I think watching Steve's patterns in the last couple of weeks, I think he's retired recently, because over the summer I've noticed he seems to be out on his lawn doing stuff in his garden times of day that before I would have never seen him. So I kind of noticed that there's been a change, but I don't have direct access to anything about his life. Now, the good part to this is that it kind of builds a certain diplomacy in how you interact, right? You sort of connect in a different way, as opposed to, you know, me making some assumption about him out mowing the lawn in the middle of the day, like he's sort of skipping a day of work. Do you know what I mean? I could sort of fall on that side as well. So when I think about the media and media silos, and generally how I operate with social media, I'm entirely aware that when I'm sharing stuff out about my day, in the general sense, anytime, that a very high percentage of the individuals that are interacting directly with what I'm posting and talking about, it's a projection into a silo of educators. Like, I'm sort of sending information out about my day with a high percentage of educators receiving it. And that's a pretty safe space to talk about stuff. So on one hand, when you say, are people sort of lighten up teachers a little bit more than usual? Well, yeah, because we're kind of the focus right now. Like, I think there really has been kind of media scrums that push the idea of education around like it's owned by one particular faction. And depending on the sort of the opponentry of it, you could have, in our particular case right now, it seems like the ministry is hanging on to one end of the rope, and somehow teachers are hanging on to the other end of the rope. And I think part of observing that space is that you feel like there's only two choices. There's only two choices in the conversation. You're either going to be in favor of what the teachers are trying to hang on to, or in favor of the Ministry of Education. Like, some of the sort of nuances of it, I think, are not really translating well through. So if you're going to be someone that's going to jump on a bandwagon and start to support something, if you're not a teacher, then I think, or you don't have necessary educators in your family, you know, your kids go to a school, I think it's easier to commodify the conversation and kind of say, who is it that I feel I can most directly impact to change what I think I want out of education? So a parent might look at that and say, well, I have to side with the government because they're saying they're giving all this money. So obviously money is going to make the in-school effect better. It's commodified, it's dehumanized, but I think that's how you could have some people messing around with educators and kind of poking and saying, like you said, kind of whiny, asking for things that are self-serving. But what the education surrounds the ministry, and it surrounds the teachers, and it surrounds the kids. Like, it's a social institution that doesn't really have walls on it. But I think because of that kind of abstract nature to it, people intentionally build little campout stations on it. So in this particular, you know, moment, there seems to be a lot of people, yeah, camping out on, you know, the one space where they're saying it's easy for them to take, you know, shots at teachers. I think there's also an element where teachers are more accessible if you decide to jump into social media. Like, you can actually, for better or for worse, get into a one-to-one conversation with an educator in a far more easier fashion than you can with Minister Lecce or Premier Ford. Like, you just can't access them at all. I mean, there's more than enough examples online of people trying to talk to them. And, you know, sometimes you get blocked. Sometimes you just get the form letter. So I think there's an accessibility space there too, where out of desperation, not even measuring the quality of conversation that's coming from someone, whether they're looking to light up a teacher or to compliment them, I think they know they can sort of hop on and grab an on-ed hashtag and get into the mix and actually have a conversation, whether they do it well or their intentions are positive or even looking to deepen their understanding. I think they're looking for the human connection. So I think that's another element of this, is that they know they can have direct impact and connection in there. So I kind of went sideways to it. I do see that if you choose to engage, like, and it goes on both sides, if you choose to engage in social media, open air reflection, like kind of like you and I do every week, you, as soon as you choose to hit, you know, share or publish or send, you do walk through a door where there could be, you don't know the scrum on the other side. You really don't. In the same way, here's the funny kind of mind mess. Anybody could send comments to our YouTube page right now and sort of post up stuff about us as representatives of education. People have access to that, but it's interesting. I guess there's a little bit of a naivete. It's not naivete. I don't often think about that, yet at the same time, someone could, because we're accessible. We're two people and accessible in real time. So they can take it one layer deeper. They could actually light us up in real time, send us a comment on the feed, and then we can choose whether or not to share it out widely in live time, but someone could go read it on the feed, but it would impact us. They would have direct access to us right now, whatever number of people could. And when you really sort of dress that down, like, you're kind of talking about millions of people that could potentially connect directly with us. I mean, that'd be a great positive spike in our ratios. But like, just think of the actual complications that would cause if we had a couple hundred people start sort of posting a concern because we've opened up this conversation space. And I will say that there's a, I do believe there's a direct correlation to educators being willing to step into that conversation space, that in an open way and in a slightly inviting way and in a vulnerable way, that's allowing both idiots and supporters to engage with them. And I think that often, as it is, I think with some social media postings, we don't often share the good stuff. It doesn't get magnified or amplified in the exact same way that this is an old news trope, right? That the news in itself always seems to sort of just always have that negative bent, and people want to chase the negative stuff because it makes them happy. Well, I think happy stuff should be able to make you happy too. It just doesn't happen as frequently in social media. So right now, education is a hot number. People are forgetting that it's bigger than just the two people in the room. There's a whole lot of other conversations going on. I think teachers are open and accessible and, to a degree, inviting conversation. I think that people are desperate to find something in the abstract that they can either fight in favor of or fight against, depending on what their priorities are in their house. And I think there's just as great an opportunity for someone to say good as something bad. It's just unfortunate all the good stuff doesn't fill the room in the way that complaints do. People can rally around a complaint. There seems to be a weird kind of embarrassment or aversion to rallying around the happy. So that's my long view.
Right on. What you said kind of leads me to want to talk about this business of being positive and the importance of it, but also the, I do like there's been a lot of negativity. Okay. And we both know that. And I don't necessarily like the negativity. I like the honesty that comes with it, because usually when people, well, maybe not. I just think there's two sides to the coin, and it's cool to be positive, but there's that whole toxic positivity thing that really gets under my skin. Like just being positive for the sake of being positive and ignoring the negative, that doesn't do anybody any favors. And maybe I like to look at that from a mental health perspective, because as someone who has a graduate degree in counseling, I know that my time is kind of outdated as I received my training many years ago, but I don't think like generally a lot of these concepts change in terms of it's important to acknowledge. And I like to look at it like from a cognitive behavioral perspective as well. So I need to make that clear. The way you think and act influence each other. And so for you to think like positively all the time, there's nothing wrong with that. But when you ignore the other parts of your thinking that kind of balance you out, I think you have a problem. And when you are always negative, that's not good either. So you need balance there, in my opinion. And I like to use myself as the guinea pig, which I know doesn't work for a lot of people, but I'll tell you, like, the way it works for me is I like to know both sides of what's happening. And then I might have my poopy pants party for a little bit, but then I will pull out of that because I know I can't live there. So for me, as an educator and as a leader, I like to know both sides. So I have a real problem with people who don't present both sides. I have a real problem with people who will come at you negative but won't share any of the positive or look at any of the positive. And then the people who are always positive and never share the negative, I believe that does me a disservice, especially like as a leader. If I want to be a leader, an educational leader, and the only perspective I ever gets the positive one, then I'm not preparing for some of the negative things that happen day to day that I really should be aware of, so that I can learn how to deal with those things, right? How to build capacity around them. That's important for me. That's my style. So I seek that out. But I think people look me sideways when I'm like, well, what's the downside here? Because there's going to be a downside. And then the response always has something to do with it. Well, it's all about students or whatever. And I'm like, that's fine. It is all about students. But if you're going to create a situation where you're going to alienate a group of educators that you need to reach the students, then I think you need to consider what's going on here. Right. And relationships are important too. So the fact that I'm even talking about how I operate is important. It's important for people to know if I'm having a conversation with you and I say to you, what's the upside? Because you keep telling me about the downside and they're like, why are you pushing back or whatever? It's like, I'm not pushing back. I'm just trying to figure out how this fits in my world. So I just think I look at both sides and that informs me. And then I decide what I want to do. And I'd like to think 90% of the time I move in a positive direction because I know that it's important to move. And that's the direction I want to move in. It doesn't mean that the negatives don't exist. It just means I'm aware of them and I'm choosing to move in the more positive way. And this has come up over the years as you and I have talked, like when we talk about change is inevitable, but I feel in education, in my experience, when there's a shift, there's a change, it's usually like there's a deficit attached. Right. It's rare that, I use the computers as an example. It's never, hey, guess what? We've got 10 extra computers to put in your class. That's not the change I usually get. The change I usually get is, well, we have more students this year. We had to add a class. So that means everybody's losing 3 Chromebooks. Oh, and then there's the, well, you know, we have to be flexible and all the good stuff that is fed to you. But can we just sit here for a minute and acknowledge that this new change means that it's going to be a little bit more difficult for me to run in a way that I saw was successful. So let's not pretend that doesn't exist. That's a pet peeve of mine. That's not cool. There's a new class. Do we operate as we normally do? And then those kids don't get any computers? Obviously, the answer is going to be no to that. But when you start to look at that perspective and you frame it that way, it kind of rounds out the conversation. It doesn't just leave you sitting in a hole and everybody walks away. It's like, yeah, this sucks. But in order for us to be equitable, and maybe not even equitable because some people might need it more than others, but in order for us to provide every class with an opportunity to use this type of technology for their learning and their achievement, this is what we have to do, right? Because we want everybody to feel the love. Let's acknowledge that there's a loss there. So change is happening. Everybody's going to be flexible. Unfortunately, there's some sad news with that comes with our change. So let's just, here's the sad news. It sucks. We can't do anything about it. So let's keep moving. And you move. For me, that's usually as simple as it is. I mean,
and this taps into part of our on-ramp, because I think that there's a parallel thing to do in that moment. That is that it doesn't have to do with it sucking. It just has to do with focusing on, a different element of the challenge. And we talked about the, I'm tapping just slightly into, I saw Ramona also, she sort of put the comment in the chat. Can you throw it up for a sec? Let's play with this tool. That last one about over planners unite, only because I like, because this was part of what you and I were talking about as we came into this, as far as the over planning goes. And I've never been, I'm not an over planner. I'm actually quite a sparse planner, but I try to be very tactical in what I'm planning. And one of the things that this on-ramp to the school season has shown me, the evidence that is in front of me, the reality that I feel is in front of me, is that I am not able to plan in a way that is as tactical or strategic as what my preference would be. and I'm trying to really neutralize the emotionality of this, I do not have at this point the information that I normally would to assure me. It's kind of like the reminder. It's interesting how the information is like a cueing system to make me feel, to make me feel calm and collected that everything is going exactly as they should. Like somehow I should have certain bits of information right now. And by not having that, my mindset wants to say that I'm not in the right place, that I'm doing something wrong, that I'm somehow inadequate because I haven't strategized in a way that I normally do. Now, I don't think whether you're sort of a sparse strategic planner, as I'm claiming to be, or let's say on the other end of the spectrum where Maharg is suggesting the over-planning, I think the planning is still the piece that I'm focusing on here. Whatever your approach is, so be it. But in doing so, here's the one suggestion, and I suggested it to you in the conversation that we started on, is that often I think what we feel comfort in, the thing that actually gives us comfort as we lead into the school year, is kind of in the first couple of the five W's. So however you strike it up, but you know, the typical kind of who, what, where, when, why, and then how. And you know, my belief, and I think where I kind of come at it is in reverse order, starting with the how. And then I think that for me, that's sort of come out of working in alt ed and the alt ed perspective, that the who and the what often would come at the end of the process. You know, you were designing a program that you could say ideally or strategically could be as open a space for anybody to get the support, both the educators being in there and the students or the children coming in, and sort of landing on the who and the what, like starting with the who and the what, I think is a very, I think that's a common approach to teachers as they get to the tail end of August and the beginning of September. I'm not sure if the why and the how is a space that teachers directly jump into. I don't know if they do. I'm just suggesting that, again, in my observation right now, what a lot of the stress is because people are very swept up in the what and the who. I think by flipping it, it's not any less stressful, but I think it gives you a different approach to kind of deal with the evidence that's being presented to us. So the evidence as I observe it right now, as from my context and the stuff that has sort of come right into my lived experience in the startup for this school year. The evidence is that no information right now is reliable. We've been told that everything could change. Now that has a whole bunch of impacts. The evidence as has been presented to me is that we do have some safety gear, we have PPE. Is it of the quality that I would have thought we were gonna have? No, I mean, mine mask kind of broke. I had a backup mask. I used my backup mask. So that's an evidence as well. The PPE is fragile, I guess. Another bit of evidence is that are the schools ready? Like our schools, as of the end of this week, is everything in place that should be for next week? The evidence that's been presented to me, no, it's not. Evidence that's been presented to me is that yes, teachers, as far as the educator family, teachers are working frantically on stuff, but so are administrators, so are other individuals within the system, caretakers, administrative staff, superintendents. Everybody is swept up in the freneticism. And the evidence that comes out of that is that that often is creating some distance and gapping out, lag in information, because whenever someone feels like they have something they need to know, the person that they need to know it from is probably consumed with something that they need to know. So everyone is kind of orbiting each other in this really sort of broad scatter graph of activity, everyone just vibrating with it. And the final thing here that the evidence seems to me is that Very personal. Every attempt I try to make at alignment right now with my former practice from last year frustrates me. So I come back to the how, the conversations about the how. And I think that this general mindset is also an attempt to recodify what's abstract right now into kind of a concrete checklist, like what we talked about last week, concrete thinkers kind of unite. Because I think that starting in such an extreme abstract frame and then bringing it back to how, as opposed to moving outwards towards how, hasn't served me well right now. And I'm looking for other individuals on both the socials and even in the conversations that I'm having with, you know, in real life with the new people that I'm meeting, the new culture that I'm experiencing at the new school, the new digs, the new setting, the new staircase, you know, the new way the doors open, everything that's kind of new about that. The slowness that I'm intentionally building into this is an attempt to observe the how, to understand the how, and to kind of make it into some concrete checklists. The last thing I just want to say on this, it also, some of the evidence, again, that I'm observing, there seems to be, I won't say seem, I'll declare it. The system in itself is not sensitive to the individual's needs. There's information that is coming down to turnaround times that are not, that it's almost suggestive that it's going to take some sort of magic or victimization of someone within the system, as in someone has to be answering emails at 10 o'clock at night, or someone has to be at work from 6 a.m. until 10 p.m. at night. And the system in itself is just the vehicle that kind of moves the information, but it's also the people in it. So I get this sense when I talk about that scattergraph of freneticism, I get the sense that everyone is really getting just rocked by this transition into September. And much like our social media conversation, I think the individuals that are kind of speaking up about it or seem to be open to conversation are kind of carrying the balls for the team. So they're the ones that are actually getting hit hardest with some of the conversations, the, you know, the direct questions, the constant barrage of email and switch. Like, individuals who have an investment education are looking for the individuals that are just willing and open to say, give me more, give me more, give me more, give me more. So that also seems to be a little bit of the evidence, the little bit of my lived context that I've observed right now. So yeah, kind of flipping the five dubs. Is it five dubs? Who, what, where, when, what? Yeah, the five dubs. I know I had to use my fingers. I'm going to use my fingers. But the how, starting with the how, I think changes the conversation a little bit. I think it gives you access to a wider array of the abstract that's kind of going on outside of our needs bubble, right? And kind of at the core, we don't have access to the who and the what right now. So much of the who and the what we do not have access to. And it's going to take individuals just kind of rolling with, as you had kind of mentioned, you're not going to have the full picture in order to start doing what you got to do next week. So you're going to go based on best information that you have at hand and be prepared to pivot. That's the final thing. Be prepared to sort of shift your practice. And even before it feels like it's your practice, even before you feel like you've actually developed a new way to deliver pedagogy in a dual system, in class and online, be prepared to shift it. So, I know it.
Yeah, the part that gets me.
Wait, take a drink. Here, cheers to you. Cheers to you. Okay, cheers. Clink. And to any other educator out there, cheers to you. Whatever it is that's in your cup at 10:38 in the morning is the right thing to be in your cup at 10:38 in the morning.
Yeah, whatever that is. The thing that kills me is the pivots. Okay, so I understand being flexible. I understand the need to pivot and to be open to pivot. It's the pivots that are the big pivots that need to be done moment to moment that kill me. Mm-hmm. They kill me because it's like, you're told, okay, this is happening now. Pivot mm-hmm. now. And then you're like, hold on a second. Let me process the pivot. Okay, I'm pivoting. And then it's like, now you need to pivot like this. It's like, whoa, I didn't pivot the first time. And they're like, that's okay, that's gone. Pivot. Like, it's this the expectation to pivot. It's just the stress of doing it right. Because when you're told to pivot, you want to pivot right. And before you can even finish the pivot, you're being told to pivot again. That's all.
I'd say just get used to pivoting. I think that's the reality. Just get used to pivoting. Get used to how that feels in your body. Get used. And it's not to say you don't want to do the right form. I don't know. Here's the question. Is it the need to do it right or the fact that you're being told to do it that causes more stress?
Well, I think this is where you start to look at different people and how different mm-hmm. people operate, because the school is made up of groups of different people. So some people, the perfectionists, I'll call them, will want to pivot perfectly the way you just told them to pivot. Other people will pivot because you told them to pivot, so they're pivoting and it's going to look dirty and messy, but hey, you said pivot, right? So you're going to have that, and you're going to have those different people dealing with things differently.
Is it as simple as though, what do you think? Are those the who and the what people? Do you think the why and the how people are pivot more easily, or do you think it's just the fact that it's a little bit of like, it's the calisthenics, right? Drop down and give me 20. Now jump up and give me jumping jacks. Now drop down and give me 20. Oh wait, no jumping jacks.
For me, it's more the coach standing in front of a bunch of people and does the direction thing. You're supposed to move in that direction. They're like, right, left, drop, up, yeah. Right. Like it's like, you can't make that look good, especially when they're going that fast. I guess if I could be selfish for a minute, mm-hmm. the thing that kills me the most is when you're told to pivot and then it's preached that, well, pivoting, it should be easy to you by now. And the person telling you to pivot is making light of it. Mm-hmm. I don't need to hear that. I don't need to hear how easy it is for you to tell me to pivot. That just frustrates me. It's almost like you're mocking me because you're like, well, you know, we told you to pivot. It's easy. Just do it. Don't mock me. Tell me to pivot. Let me pivot. If you have suggestions on how I could be more effective in my pivot, let me know. But don't take my personal way of pivoting and turn it into something that you're going to use to like joke about. That's not funny to me. That's mm-hmm. like doing that to you and being insensitive of your needs or requirements. Like let's have a very simple example. This podcast. It was like 2 weeks ago or something, 3 weeks ago, where I messaged you and I said, I can't cast tomorrow morning. This is happening. After I told you I could, you're like, okay, no problem. Then the next morning, my plans changed and I messaged you and I said, hey, my plans have changed. I'm open to cast if you're open to cast. And you're like, I am. And you pivoted. But had you said no, and then I come at you with like, or had you said, well, give me half an hour to figure out if the family's like, are we staying home? Are we going out? Because we're not going out when I podcast, but you said we weren't podcasting. So I pivoted and I said to the family, hey, we can go do something now. For me to tell you, hey, I'm staying home now, can you cast in 30 minutes? And you're like, well, let me check in with my family. Then me hitting you back with, don't waste your time. Just tell them what you're going to do. Don't ask. Just tell me coming at you and getting in your face about pivoting when I clearly have already gotten you to pivot twice. Now I'm looking to get you to pivot a third time, but I'm in your face. I don't know about you. I have no love for that. Maybe it's something I need to learn. I guess maybe it's something great to learn about how to deal with people in your face. I don't know. But
I like what you're introducing, the idea that, you know, the realities are negotiable. Because we've had the conversations too where one of us has pushed back and said, I can't. Like you said, like there's something that's kind of slotted in, and then we kind of like negotiate. And we've actually ended in a space where, you know, there's been a couple times we didn't get to the cast. Like it just couldn't be put back in its box. And we've both moved on. Like we said, like, okay, we didn't get to the cast this week. There's something in that element that isn't happening right now in these conversations up and down the system. Because I do think that there's information, actionable information that's coming down to school-based systems. So from the broader system, that it is not, there's a disregard of impact on the humans having to deliver that. You know, the oversimplified example is when actionable items are coming in at 10 p.m. at night for things that need to be kind of in motion by 8 or 9 a.m. the next morning. Like I get this idea that these kind of emails are constantly flowing back and forth. Again, it's the tumult. It's that sort of like the waters that are just thrashing so much with different information that it's not even easy to set. The direction is actually being set by the river flow, just because it's flowing in one direction, not because you're actually paddling in that direction. So, you know, as I observe, you know, I'm in the school and things are constantly, you know, we get one and then we get an update in our system and then there's another update in the system. It just, again, it reminds me of how dynamic the stuff that's happening in the background, and imagining what that sort of checks and balance looks like for the people that actually are saying, oh, here's another in-time delivery of something. And then someone going, really? Like, I just sent an email. I just sent something in motion and you have to change. And one of the things that I wonder is, you know, as I said, you and I have redirected our pod to not exist sometimes. We've admitted that it's not going to happen within the frame that we are prepared to deliver it, right? It's fallen outside of the scope of possibility. What does that conversation look like in education right now? Who has the luxury of being able to entertain that conversation where you would directly say, this is not going to happen for Thursday? And it's not because I don't want to. It's because you haven't pulled these other elements out of my way. You haven't pulled these other barriers away from me. If someone can pull those barriers away and kind of put them somewhere else or redeploy them somewhere else, then I can get to these two or three things that just hit my table. There's something that's happening in this on-ramp where the sort of human and the machine have kind of become one. That somehow just because you send five different changes, that those five different changes can be absorbed, processed, synthesized, and sort of moved into actionable spaces. Because the cost right now is individuals having to stay up till midnight for the fear that it's the FOMO, that there's going to be something that has to be actioned first thing in the morning. And it's better to just stay up late and wait to take the right hook than to wake up in the morning completely bruised and incapable of, you know, being able to move. So there's something happening in the system where I think there's been a hyper-reliance on the movement of electronic information, and the actual relationship between the humans moving it is being kind of obscured by the dynamicism of it. And I do worry. I worry for the leadership. I worry for SOs. I worry for admin. I worry for the wellness and the humanity of these individuals that are getting really wagged by some of these changes. And it's a human fault. It's a system pressure and tension, but it's a human fault here that if there's individuals pushing back and saying this can't be done, that there isn't the space for that to be received and somehow something be changed, right? Because I worry for in September that we hear about, I mean, a lot of people, here's the thing, we're hearing a ton of chatter around teachers taking leaves. Haven't even heard any chatter about leadership and administrators taking leaves because they've been broken by just the constant tension and pressure of having to have a school up and running by next week. And I have deep, deep concern for individuals in those spaces. Deep, deep concern. quitting, early retirement, heart attack, like just the stuff that, you know, the body's getting worn down. So.
And you know what? I would have laughed at you, like the heart attack or the early retirement. I would have laughed at you 10 years ago. What are you kidding me? No way. I'm not laughing anymore. Mm-hmm. Those are real things. Like, those are real things. And it's scary. They're humans too, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to shift and I don't want to shift. Ramona's drinking chai tea. That's what she's got going on. And a good question from Ramona around the overplanning that we just kind of talked about, that you talked about, is overplanning mm-hmm. a way of trying to cover all the conceivable pivot possibilities? If I plan 10 different things, one of them will work or be quickly changed when the pivot occurs. This is an interesting question to me because I agree with her and I disagree with her. I would say, like, yes, but there's no way you're going to cover all conceivable pivot possibilities, in my opinion. There's no way. You don't really know what the pivot's going to be. But, it does help to have some backup plans for sure. So I agree with her there that overplanning is I don't mind overplanning because there's always a situation I've found in my career where I've had to pivot quickly for a number of different reasons, but I have something to lean on, right? And those things become some of the overplanning doesn't need to happen as you get deeper into your school year because you understand your students and you've built in routines and other like ways of operating in order for them to function in a positive way when you have to shift. So for example, there have been a few times where the kids come in from recess and I've got this great lesson plan, but like one of my administrators will walk in and say, hey, there was a situation. I need to talk to you about the situation now. And I'm like, no problem. Kids, go to your personal projects, books, and continue working on. And it's something that's been laid out and you've built a capacity with them around this work or this concept. And so they know what to do when you activate that protocol. So as soon as I say personal project time, they know what to do and how to do it in a way that's effective and useful while I deal what's come to me at my door that I can't say no to. Like I can't say no, come back later. I mean, I guess I could, but if that person's in there like ready to interrupt what's about to happen, then I know that it's important. So there's a difference between over planning and building in processes and protocols. So I would say that personally, for the start of the school year, I overplan just because I don't know my kids and I don't know what's going to pop up, especially this year. But in a month, if you said to me, hey, are you overplanned for today? I'd say no. I'd say, here's my plan for today. And if something interrupts that plan, I will pivot. But I have protocols in place that have taught my students how to pivot as well, into something that won't cause them anxiety, into something that is a routine for them now. That's how I would answer that question.
Hmm. I think I would still ground myself. I would call what you described, I would say, as planning. I don't take that as over planning. I think the shift for me is when you move between what is and what if. So again, what is a evidence in front of you checklist of the type of planning that you need to do. A backup lesson is a what is. Having a binder of backup lessons is a what if. And I won't do that. I won't plan for that. I just won't. And I think that it comes down to the way that she framed the question, but to cover all the conceivable pivot possibilities is the exact impossibility that I'm saying we shouldn't spend time on. take it back to a narrower list. And if the things that you are planning based on what is are not enough, then it's a totally different conversation that needs to come out of that. So if, as an example, if you're having to do a backup or an emergency lesson plan, that's one emergency lesson plan. So if you're, and that's kind of, for me, the criteria of that emergency lesson plan. The what is about that emergency lesson plan is that emergency lesson plan has to be connected with something that the kids can do. So it's not, it is a one-off as in it happened maybe randomly, but it's also the, it's also an indicator that for whatever reason, I couldn't deliver regular programming. So we need something connected with programming that the kids can continue to do without too much of a bump. That's a what is. If after that single backup lesson plan, I am still not capable. So again, evidence, I am still not capable of being there to deliver curriculum. That's a brand new conversation. It's not me having seven plans ready. Because I think that's where some of this gets heightened into anxiety. That, and if I were to put the over planning, I don't feel the safety and security of over planning. Because I think that ultimately it moves me. I guess where I'm prepared to do the grind is when I know I need to do it. I'm not prepared to do the grind ahead of time before I have evidence that tells me I need to do that. Now, I understand the structure of designing a course. I understand the fundamental qualities of course design and program design and having to sort of the long-term plans. But even long-term plans are based on the what is just before the long-term plan. It is a stack and it moves in a progression. If evidence is introduced that that progression is no longer viable, that's a different conversation. And to have a, just because someone tells you that in 5 minutes you have to pivot to something new and you say, well, good thing I have all this other stuff I can jump on, I won't do that. I may push back and say, I can't do it in 5 minutes. I cannot humanly do this in 5 minutes. And I think that's the nature that we need to have more conversations like that, because the synthesis of human and machine and the over, for me, my word, overcompensation of having multiple adjacent plans becomes, again, like that's just wellness breaking. That's absolutely wellness breaking. So I would say if the over planning is based on what if, for me, it's not the right planning. If it's based on what is, and you can speak to the how and the why, and that's the type of planning that I'd like to focus on.
What if versus what is?
And it's hard. It's hard to stay focused. It's hard to stay focused on what actually is right in front of you, because that can be a stunner. That can be a real stunner for you to sort of confront what's actually in front of you.
It was good talking to you,
dude. Season 4.
Season 4, craziness. I can't believe how far we've come. It's going to be an interesting week. It's going to be a very interesting week. I do have excitement. I have more excitement than anxiety, actually. And to tell you the truth, which is, it's really going to sound weird, it's the first time in a long time I'm okay to start the school year. There, I've had many years in my profession where I don't look forward to the start of the school year. To be honest with you, I don't like the way that schools traditionally start the school year. I don't like the gathering in the gym and teachers calling out the names. I don't like it at all. I don't like it. It doesn't feel good to me. It never has. And even as an adult, a professional, and now I'm learning to deal, like I've dealt with it, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm learning to get past it. But there's something deep inside me that doesn't like the traditional start of the school year. I've never felt comfortable with it as a student, as a teacher. That's why I think if I ever become a principal, I would like to shift the way school year starts in a building. Mm-hmm. When I did like it a little bit better, it was at my last school, because my last school did it differently. They had a couple of days before the school year started, they had a sneak peek. So you come into the school with the kids come in with their parents, and you pick up the package of papers that normally I would give to you on the first day, and you find out who your teacher is. And, you know, you're not supposed to walk around the school, but people always do, and they find the room. And when I worked at that school, I was there on that day so that I could see these people and say hello, and they could see who I am. And it breaks the ice so that on the first day of school, I don't have to read out 26 names. You're like, Mr. C's my teacher. There's Mr. C. And they come over. And instead of breaking the ice, we're more building relationship at that moment. So the ice is broken. You came in on Thursday. You had half a day to do it. And most of you came in. And you got to see me. You got to see the room. You got your package. So you've got your papers all filled out. I don't have to hound you for it. That, I like that. And I know I've heard the reasons why principals don't want to do it that way. But I think if I were a principal, I would shift into that realm, because I see the mental health benefits. And there's always going to be somebody that disagrees with you, but I see benefits to that. And I'm not telling my staff they have to come in on that day. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying the kids can come in and the kids can know who their teacher is, and it will alleviate stress, because the kids aren't walking around like, I don't even know who my teacher is. They will know already. So there's a lot of things that I would change about the start of school year. And a lot of things that have weighed heavily on me for many years, even as an adult who's getting over that stuff, I can't deny it's there. It's still there. It's just what I do with it that's different. So in a way, I kind of like this start, that we're not all going to be together in the gym. I dislike that part of it very much. Dislike it very much. I like this staggered start. Let's get these young kids in. Let's get them to figure out how this is going to work. So when they come to school the next day, they know what they're doing, and then we can work on the next group. I like this. I think I could get used to this as a teacher and as maybe a principal one day. I could get used to this, because I think to ease in to a transition after being at home all summer, and in this case, being away from school building for 6 months, I think it's the way to go. That's just me, though.
No, I'm on board with that.
So on that note, Chris, I wish you a great first week.
Thanks, man.
And Ramona wishes us a good week as well. Same to you, Ramona, and anybody else who's listening. We hope you have a great first week of school. Maybe you've started. Maybe you're not starting until another week from the first week because you're high school. I don't know. When you get started, have a good one. Mm-hmm. Give yourself the permission to make the mistakes. Give yourself the permission, not be hard on yourself. Keep yourself and your students as safe as you can. And that's all we can do to start, right?
For sure. I am similar feels. Want to just drop into there. I'm sort of put together a creator circle. So you can check my feeds for that. So the intent with this is a mini wellness project for educators, if they want to jump in and share their, you know, maybe their creative energy needs to be sparked, or their creative energy has been, you know, off the charts, and they want to talk about what they've been making and creating in the past little while. So if anyone's interested in that, they can check my Twitter feeds or my Insta feeds. The hashtag is WKWAB, so words keep wolves at bay. And also, if anyone's interested in a book club that's coming down the pipe, again, you can find that on my feed, the Praxis Book Club. And we're looking at The Courage to be Disliked, a book. So, yeah, but those connections, you can find them on my feed on Twitter, and reach out. Love to have a few more people involved.
Right on.
And big love to all the educators out there. Big, big love. Oh, here, I'll show you. So that was the...
It's a turtle, and there are different facial expressions on the turtle. Is that right?
That is correct.
Cool, I like it. Moving nice and slow, unless we get dumped in the water.
Slow, we take that as the password. Slow, code slow word.
Password.
That's the code breaker word.
That's also going to be the title for this episode.
Take it slow?
No, just slow.
Slow. All right.
Or slow-mo, whatever.
Slow-mo. All right, dude. Thanks for your time. I appreciate you.
Yeah, you too. Talk to you later. Have a good one.
You too.